At the third stroke, it will be...
Hey everyone, and welcome to the EUC Digest Throwdown, a monthly recording with all the hosts of the EUC Digest crew. And in this month, we kind of discuss another couple of topics of the EUC space. My name is Ingmar Verheij, and for this episode, I am your host. Just like previous months, this episode will be available as a podcast and on our YouTube channel. If you have not seen our previous episode, then you have missed us talk about the conferences, which we dearly miss, new community experts, Salesforce declaring an end to the 9-to-5 workday, Microsoft Viva, and some tips on music when working from your home. Now, before we start with the first topic of today, let us highlight our sponsor, Liquidware.
Yes, Liquidware provides adaptive workspace management solutions for all Windows desktops. The company products encompasses all facets of management to ensure the ultimate user experience across all workspaces, physical, virtual, DAS, or in the cloud.
Wow, thank you. So, talking about Liquidware, we've made a joke before, but it's March, and today I got myself an excellent bottle of, it's a Grillo Cipriano from Sicily. Apparently, it's one of their native grapes, and this bottle, I've been told by my liquor store, never leaves the island, but because of COVID, they couldn't sell it locally, and I'm so much looking forward to this drink, maybe even more than a podcast. Guys, what are you drinking?
Wouldn't you rather go to that island then?
Oh, yeah. Can I leave now?
No, not now, because in the plane we'll be...
No, we should record a podcast there, right? Just face-to-face.
Yeah, sure.
Next month.
Yeah.
Next
I
month.
Agree.
Yeah. Hey, but I think this is
you don't have to you don't have to fly to Sicily, Eric. You can actually drive and then take a boat.
Of course,
oh, we went to Sardinia a couple of years back. So,
yeah. Oh, awesome! I'm drinking a Highland Baron, which is pretty much a cheap whiskey, but I mix it up with a Diet Coke.
With cheap Coke.
Cheap? No. It's actually the original one. So just to give it a better taste.
Okay. All right. Product placement.
Yeah. Sure. Hey, but I think this is also the part we should introduce ourselves. And I did prepare myself this time, going up with the well and all kind of stuff. But my name is Eric van Klaver, and I did a thing this afternoon. You all know I'm not that sporty. At least I'm not that sporty one of you guys. But this afternoon, I took out the bike and I went for a biking, cycling or pedaling, whatever it's called, bicycling? Around the Hoi Mir. And I really enjoyed it.
There you go.
That's the thing. Thanks for sharing the story.
Did you have training wheels?
nice one. Respect. No, but it did had a child back seat
and a little flag on
Hoi Mir.
The
how many kilometers is that?
No, it's not around. I did 15 kilometers.
He cut off the corners.
But yeah,
halfway he turned back, right?
So for the people who are not Dutch, Hoi Mir is actually a lake.
Yeah.
So if you cut corners on a lake, then you basically, you're in
you
the water,
wet.
Right?
Water cycle.
Yeah,
but if there's,
it's a water bike.
Moment.
If there's a child seat behind, I mean, it's not really sporting. I mean, did your wife do all the work, or how did that go?
No.
Okay.
But nice one.
On.
Thank you, Amar, for spoiling my moment. I was really. I think you all would be like,
proud,
oh, dude, did
proud.
You really go, Sekmar, on a bike or and go for, go some do something to get this body in shape?
There you go. Well done, man. Well done.
Yep.
Thank you. Yes. So I am drinking a gin tonic because the spring kind of started today in the Netherlands. Well, we had like kind of a spring weather for the last couple of weeks as well. But today it's, you know, there's sunshine. There's we just sat in the backyard, just in my t-shirt, enjoying the sun. So and you know what's better than one gin tonic? It's actually two gin tonics.
You know what's better than two gin tonics?
That's
three.
It. Double fisted. One is none. And this is a, so if we're just, you know, we're doing product placement anyways, this is a aviation gin from Ryan Reynolds, the actor who played Deadpool, which is one of my favorite movies.
There you go.
So actually, and don't do the Padum Bats, right? But buy.
Yeah. You have one called Sun Bai. Good pun. Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah.
So this was yours.
This joke is so bad it doesn't earn a like a.
But we all now know Johan has a new toy.
Yeah.
Good. Anyone else who wants to go before we go to the first topic?
Well, I just
Kate is drinking coffee, right?
So, yep. No alcohol for me, guys.
Is this keto or what's
same
what's
here.
With the coffee, dude?
Yeah.
Yep. No carbs.
It's but there are no carbs in gin or in whiskey.
Excellent.
You could look it up.
Excellent.
I did.
Maybe right. Kate, there's some work to do.
To make sure that we still have listeners, because we've been talking about for 5 or 10 minutes on drinks. This is actually an EUC podcast. I'm not sure if anyone realized here, but so we all submit topics. First of all, Case, he was on a roll. If it was up to Case, this would be a 2-hour session. So we try to keep it below an hour. We got some feedback. Thank you for that. But no promises. So first topic, OVH. Which is a French cloud computing company. They offer VPS, dedicated servers, and other web services. And actually, I use OVH myself. They were in the news the other day. One of their big data centers in Strasbourg, which is in France, it caught fire and was engulfed in flames. And as a result, and this is interesting, thousands of sites and businesses were affected. Now, obviously, they're working around the clock to get things, you know, fixed again. When the flames are done, then they can start rebuilding. But it raised a couple of questions, at least to me. How on earth is it possible that popular web services like, you know, WordPress, Rocket, Imagify, or a game service Rust, how come they did not have a disaster recovery? I mean, OVH, they too, they offer a disaster recovery plan, and that worked, okay? And thousands of customers, they permanently lost their data. How is that possible? I mean, obviously, we tend to say, you know, cloud is just someone else's computer. Is this the wake up call we all needed?
It's I think it's one of them, right? I think it's a continuous process of people being aware of the fact that just lifting and shifting infrastructure towards cloud is not solving all your problems. And it doesn't lift you from responsibilities either. So if you move to cloud, that's perfectly fine. It's for me, it's just one of the tools in the toolbox, right? It's not ends to mean, it's just a way to get to a certain point in time or a certain kind of dot on the horizon. And all of the items that apply when you look at infrastructure on premises will also apply in cloud. It will also indulge in performance, in UX, in availability, DR, all of that, business continuity. I know that somebody wrote a book around that specifically for end user computing. I'm looking at you, Johan. But it to a lot of people it makes sense to look at the infrastructure services as that there's no real difference between on premises and public cloud, but somehow we all assume that when you put something in cloud, it suddenly all goes away and you have zero responsibilities and everything is kind of arranged by default, which is an interesting concept.
Yeah, it
what
is.
Do you I mean, think it's because I see you nodding. In disagreement for once.
It was to example on premises versus like consuming resources at a maybe a hyperscaler or differ. You need to look at high different levels. So it's more in the application layer maybe instead of like the hypervisor layer or even lower, right? On the hardware layer. So you need to reassess all your HA plans when it comes to your application availability, where you're just consuming like an infrastructure or even a service.
Because you consume something as a service doesn't mean that service is always 100% as you expect, right? I mean, for one, I don't think there are cloud services that actually provide an SLA. Actually, there's no SLA where they say, if we don't meet the standards, then this is you know, the money you get in return. I don't see a difference, honestly. I mean, if there's always the question of what if, what if something goes different than that we expected? What if this service breaks down? What if they go bankrupt? That could happen. Who owns the data? Who owns the, what if I no longer have access to my data? What, how does this hurt my business? And if I read, thousands of web services, honestly, if my web services would have been there, nothing. There's nothing important on my websites. If you are a professional service providing, there you go, services.
This company, because I looked it up, right? Because in our pre-discussion, I had doubts about this topic, but I looked it up what they did. They also do a lot of Dockers and all those other kind of stuff, like micro apps and APIs integration, especially for, I think, the major of websites or applications which are consumed nowadays make use of those micro apps or microservices. So if this goes down, this definitely will impact your organization or your experience with that application or service.
But without looking specifically to OVH, right? So it could happen every big hyperscaler as well. But what you need to do, why are organizations that offers backup services for Microsoft 365 earning money? Simply because you can trust Microsoft that they could, keep your mailbox online, your Microsoft 365 service online, but trust them to create backups out of it and relying your entire business on it is very risky. So
yeah, definitely.
And if you have a cloud strategy as an organization, you should also need to incorporate a DR scenario, your exit strategy, your all sorts of things that you normally don't think about when you go into cloud. This event shows again how important it is to don't rely on a single organization.
Why would you? If you go into cloud, don't think about those things. Why?
I think Johan just said that you should. Regardless if it's cloud.
But he said, but they don't think about this. And my question is, why wouldn't you think about this? Because this, like you said before, Ingmar, this is just somebody else's bigger computer. Still have the same.
Most companies that we work with are currently building a cloud strategy. They had cloud fear for many years. Data which normally resides on-prem now currently moves towards cloud. And it is all new. It's still, although many cloud services like Dropbox or Salesforce exist for many, many, many years. But a strategy, a cloud strategy with something like an exit strategy is fairly new to most companies. Another example in this regard, AWS is probably the biggest or one of the biggest hyperscalers in the world. AWS also does in mortgages. Now many banks, like bigger banks in the Netherlands, are currently ABN AMRO has a daughter. How do you call it? Like a sub organization, a sub bank, specifically for business loans, which is 100% based on AWS services. Now, for such a bank, Amazon can be seen as a competitor as well.
I know. Now, I have a couple of those companies as well who already stated that this is a threat to them because they have the data and the insights and they're hosting on their hyperscaler.
Now imagine you being such a bank and the hyperscaler that your or the data center that your data currently resides in goes down. This means something to Amazon as a competitor as well, in terms of income or maybe getting more what?
It's a competitive advantage, right? It's down, right? Even though you're
servicing. Yeah.
But it's all about trust, right? For every hyperscaler or even
is it
regional managed services organizations?
It's just like building on-prem solutions, it's looking at risks and mitigating those risks. And those risks can be based on DR, could be based on security, can be based on trust, can be based on anything. But if you're going to build a solution on which your entire business is relying on, take those things into account. And then at the end, it doesn't really matter if your solution is in the cloud or not.
Yep. And I mean, quite honestly, I mean, it's, I think it's, what you said, it's true. Like, it's not if you buy a solution, but you're building an organization. You've got responsibilities. You provide a service to your customers, and for that, you use technology. Those customers moving to cloud as a service, that's like outsourcing a service. So that's a way to perceive, right? I'm outsourcing a couple of responsibilities to the service provider. But just because you outsource a couple of responsibilities to a third party doesn't mean you're no longer responsible for that data. And we know that with especially with data, right? Just because someone else is processing the data doesn't mean you're no longer responsible for keeping it secure and safe. So I think key point here is I would say this is a fair warning. Just because you're going to a hosted service provider or a cloud service, always keep in the back of your mind, what if things go wrong? And I actually have a good example of what if things go wrong. So I wanted to use this as a segue. And actually, Johan, you were already alluding to this in a bit. There has been small issue with Microsoft Exchange. There was an emergency security update released early in March because there was a vulnerability in Microsoft Exchange. And obviously, we all know Microsoft Exchange as a popular mail service. The thing is, with issuing such a patch for a vulnerability, is that the time between issuing the patch and actually customers implementing, there's a gap, which means in between, hackers probably use that time to start hacking or exploiting that vulnerability. And that's something what we've seen in the past weeks, because it's fairly new, that a lot of customers actually haven't implemented this patch. And in fact, we know that even before Microsoft knows about this vulnerability, and normally there's a process where a hacker says, hey, I found an exploit. Are you willing to negotiate on the terms to which you would agree on the term on the period in which Microsoft gets the opportunity to fix this? And after that, then the hacker or security expert will publish their article on how to figure this out. The thing is, so many customers were either not aware of this patch, or simply they did not have the mechanisms in place to apply this patch, that as a result, they are basically sitting ducks. They are exposed and maybe not even aware. And the only exception to this, well, the biggest exception to this, was Exchange Online. So every Office 365 customer was safe simply because it was a cloud service. So Microsoft, and this is Microsoft patching Microsoft, they can patch it once and everyone is safe. So this kind of translates into, this is why you need a cloud service. This is one of the selling points of using cloud. And I see Case already smiling like,
evergreen. Mine.
So for me, there's two things to that comment, Ingmar. So first of all, I noticed that there's a public record of Exchange servers where the patch is being applied in terms of numbers. And there's still about 1,300 Exchange servers in the Netherlands alone that are not patched. That is a massive number of unpatched servers. And I guess your point was right. Maybe companies are not tasked to actually apply these patches. But come on, it's a very brutal kind of security patch or security flaw. And Microsoft made it really easy to apply that with just a few clicks into your Exchange org. So if you're listening to this and you have Exchange on-prem, please reach out to your Exchange admin and make sure that he applies the patch. The second point that I wanted to make.
Dude,
Johan,
2005 called. They want their patch mechanism back.
You're right. So the second thing I wanted to add is while Exchange Online is a great service and having the ability to patch once, and I do air quotes, is a great kind of idea when it comes down to dispatching. We also saw that Microsoft took down complete Azure zones because one certificate was not renewed on time. So while this might be a kind of a positive thing for cloud computing in general, the impact when something goes wrong is also a lot bigger. So it's kind of this oil stain but it, in both a positive and a negative way.
I mean, I figured Johan would jump in here, but I agree. So, and I think this is, again, a call to action for organizations to, for one, start following, like, when are vulnerabilities being presented and what are patches being available. Get your patch management, like, in place. If you are on-prem, if you manage your own products, then make sure that happens. I mean, we've seen this. I've seen this closely. Roughly 12 months ago, last year, Citrix ADC, there was a vulnerability. A patch was released in December. Not everyone applied it. And then shit hits the fan because you're not aware if you've been hacked with all the, you know, all the things which actually was the result of being hacked, because then they're in your system. And then, hey, you know what? There are probably more issues. And in fact, back then, what was it again? The National Security Cyber Center, they advised customers to shut down access to their data center, which is horrible. They caused traffic jams because people had to work in the office. I say again, in the office, can imagine where it's when, like, a year later, now everyone is at home. But
what's
just saying,
they were crazy. Why? You can't go to an office.
Well, I mean,
right. I mean, what is actually causing this? Is laziness, or is it just to complain, to make sure always applying your security patches, etc.? But obviously, a lot of organizations, well, there is a challenge, right?
So I'd say, so my take on this is, and I know Johan wants to jump in by now, but so many customers simply do not have the IT staff qualified and sufficient to actually know about all the things they have to do to stay secure in a world which is constantly under attack. So that's why, for those customers, cloud could be an option. But then again, coming back to the OVH story on disaster recovery, just because you're going to a cloud service, that will help you address these challenges, right? Because Microsoft will patch for you, or VMware will patch for you, NVIDIA, whatever cloud service you can assume. There are a lot of things which they, which doesn't mean there's no more responsibility for you. You still have to have a DR recovery. You have to have backup plans. What if Azure AD goes down, which happened last week, right? If you cannot log into your data center, what does it mean? Or to your, if you cannot access your application, you got to have a plan B or plan C. And that could be, guys, you're all on garden leave, like Johan, sit in the garden, enjoy the sun. That could be. If that works out, yeah, good. I think that's excellent. But even if you go to cloud service, so Exchange Online, I think it's a solution for so many, because a lot of people simply are not mail admins like they used to be in the past. And then actually, I mean, yeah, no, let's stop there.
I know, yeah. I once spoke mine is just short, Johan. Johan,
yeah. Just, oh, really? That's what she said.
Yeah. I once spoke to a I did several times, but this was once a quote from a big C-level director of a bank, and he told me, "But Eric, do I pay my IT staff enough? Do I invest enough in IT to get everybody educated enough to stay enough on track to be secure, to stay up to date with all the latest and greatest? So do I pay enough? I pay $4 million a year. Is that enough?"
There's not about
I
money.
Don't have the answer.
Obviously not. I mean, it's a risk. Risk is chance times impact. There's always a chance, and impact is only getting bigger. No one is secure. There's no such thing as a secure environment. Even when it's when you're completely disconnected, even you're never secure. That's you know, it's sure a fairy tale.
Yeah,
you always pay too much.
Oh, go on, yeah, go that's ahead. For sure. Yeah.
I cut you off.
No, I'm good. Let's continue.
This was my cue. I was not prepared. So actually. Sorry for that. And actually, this topic was actually submitted by Yitz. And Yitz, maybe you want to take this one, which is
on
VMware vSphere. Yeah, I mean, you send it in, and I was like, hey, this is super interesting, but I have no clue what you're trying to say here. So please jump in.
That's what I normally have with Yitz.
I don't understand the case. Just kidding. Keep it muted. Yeah, so earlier this month, exactly to be on March 9th, VMware released their vSphere 7 Update 2 version, right? So, and although you could assume this, well, okay, Update 2, maybe this is just a minor release, and I leave it completely up to each and every one of you using vSphere or ESXi as a hypervisor in their environment or any other hypervisor, right? But the vSphere 7, and maybe this is just a cheap product placement, but this is not my intention. To remember partnership to get VIA and VMware pricing artificial intelligence for each and every end user in enterprise environments. So what I and let me maybe just a little bit go a couple of steps back, right? In IT, where CorelDRAW or Corel applications on Windows 95 machines and towards where we are today with end-user computer applications, end-user in a secure and efficient and organizations. Users out there, just researchers, organizations, and they basically for decades there completely had to rely on their own. Were building their white label machines, do-it-yourself approaches, and basically they were like shadow AI, right? They were building their own solutions. And most of the time, this was asked those data scientists, end users, the question, what is it that you need? The typical answer would be, okay, I need a supercomputer in order to do my job. And now with the things that we have seen together with VMware and also with NVIDIA, of course, but also with many other vendors, the democratizing AI world or approach is where we now we can simply provide a like VDI type solution researcher and provide them access to this supercomputer or a small chunk of this supercomputer work. So my call out would those are computing listeners. Go on. So for all those familiar with computing, familiar with providing CorelDRAW on a Windows 95 CPU today, there is all those data, all those researchers, all those shadow AI workloads in the same approach as what we have done with VDI, for example. Secure, remote, centralized, virtualized access to workloads, to resources where they can run their AI workloads with the over the couple of decades today. So my call out would be VMware, it's not about NVIDIA, it's about these users that we need to, embrace in the end user computing world.
So yes,
there's an addition to that. What you're doing with from the infrastructure like layer until the application layer and everything that's in the middle, like you mentioned, that was mostly built customly built by organizations, and it's hard to automate anything in customized stacks, right? So being able to completely integrate the data science side of things into a CI/CD pipeline and automating the creation of let's say application stacks or stuff like load balancers, stuff like the security side of things is now included in that solution. And customers had always had a hard time picking the right hardware. Now you can, choose building blocks, add them to the infrastructure, scale out, integrate with NVIDIA GPUs, automatically get the latest version of your data science applications from the NVIDIA graphics cloud. Everything is tied together. And it's not that it's not yet here. You can... Some of those things are already available, but I think the partnership and also with some other companies as well, like Intel, You know, you have a complete data science stack.
Yes. So I'm sorry, but I'm going to stop you here. This is so. First of all, yet you started with a cheap product placement. No, VMware and NVIDIA. That's definitely not cheap. So it's not a cheap product placement. Thanks. But democratizing the term in itself means you're making it more widely available to others, and I think it's a good step in the direction for sure. I think if you talk about democratizing AI, then you know, we need to look at Azure Cognitive Services, AWS, because democratizing AI means you're making it available to a broader audience beyond just the researchers, as in your own researchers, but actually, hey, I am doing AI, and it's for the greater good, and I'm sharing it with other scientists. So for that, you need a cloud scale service. And I think this is a good step in the direction. Don't get me wrong. I think it's good that it's easier to deploy this in with building blocks, but still on-prem, guys. It's still, it's VDI. It's not modernizing. It's just making it slightly more better available than the machine behind the desk. But then again, it's 2020, guys. This is
2021, eh?
Sorry, there you go. I missed a year. Still, even in 2020,
we all missed a year. Already,
this is not.
No. Yeah, you're right, Ingmar. Right. I mean, democracy other than just the scope or the context of just one enterprise, right? But now we have to take little step. Step is to make sure that within an enterprise organization, and can works based on the centralized and virtualized platform, right? In a supported, optimized and environment. So, but I fully agree with you. I have to say, for those organizations that I come across on the day, when they're prototyping or even training or inferencing with cloud services, many of the organizations, especially little startups or not little, but startups, they start with consuming services at a hyperscaler. Well, they have struck oil and they want to ramp up to production and they really need to train their models. They go because it's simply too expensive, or the latency that the hyperscaler introduces with getting all the data towards the hyperscaler introduces too much latency. So many of those organizations, as soon as they're hitting their production stage, they're shifting back towards. So, and of course, this doesn't count for each and every use case, but this is something that we see, on more than one occasion.
I think this is good that you mentioned it. I think one of the trends that we'll see and already been seeing for the last years is that we will see more AI on the edge. So we see more edge computing, and AI is definitely one of those components where for certain calculations, certain models, you want it to be on the edge simply because you need that quick interaction. I mean, there's the corny example of the Tesla car where you want to do this in the machine simply because if you do AI in the cloud, then there's a child in front of you. You know, it's probably dead by the time that you get the response that it was a child and it had a break. Nonetheless, I would still say good sales pitch, great story. It's democratizing GPU access. And I think, you know, I agree on that. But democratizing AI, I'd say that's the AWS, the Azures, the Googles, and et cetera, of these worlds. These guys, and probably the specialists where AI, as in learning, applying machine learning and you know, growing knowledge, you need to have a cloud scale environment. Johan.
Well, true, but with okay, the lack of GPUs at this moment, it doesn't really matter if you got it on-prem or in the cloud. You know, even
you're just happy when you have them.
Cannot get.
I mean, that's because all these people are mining with these GPUs, like AI, and then they're
call Remco.
Yeah, it's like it's democratizing bitcoins. Anyhow,
yeah,
it's good stuff.
Those
then.
GPUs were actually AMD, Eric.
Yeah, and old ones.
Ah.
I'll take them.
But honestly, right? The message out there is that there are a lot of people in the EUC environments that have the knowledge how to intuitive and effectively serve resources to end users in their organizations, to their colleagues, right? And in many organizations, there are colleagues that we can, because they have these special requirements, the data scientists and the researchers. And now, And again, right? So this isn't just with VMware. This is with all, and not even hypervisor. But now we have ability. I remember those days when we had the server-based computing environments on Windows NT 4, and there was like for a local government, right? There were always a couple of guys.
Still way back, yes.
No, but they were using these workstation workload, right? They had 2D, 3D applications. And somewhere in 2013 or even before that, we were capable of getting those special into the centralized and virtualized environment.
With NT4.
No. Okay. We had 1,000, right? No, but today there are these specials which we can still serve in a different way. So, right, if you look at the workflow of a generalizing here, right, but if we look at the shadow AI type approach or the do-it-yourself, they go to the Best Buy or, okay, the MediaMarkt around the corner, they buy some hardware, build drivers, get everything aligned just for one framework to train, for example. And I've seen these examples many times, spending, I don't know, maybe 1 or 2 weeks just to train one framework. And this is actually the work that they want to do. That's their daily goal, right? That's what they want. It's not building up this entire stack. That's the central IT's work. But
I think
there was always this mismatch, right? So, and now, and as with NGC, NVIDIA GPU Cloud, but also, of course, with GitHub in general, the ability just to consume a framework, just to consume a pre-trained model. I mean, who hasn't been out there using like the YOLO network to do some object detection? You can just train it with some other objects just in there and use it for your own purpose. But you want to do this a device or a virtual machine and just retrain it. You don't want... Oh.
But yes, honestly, if I just want to spin up something, I just grab my credit card and I just spin it up. I don't want to go to my IT guy and say, did you buy this great tool, this great toy that NVIDIA
Imar, just to be fair, I think we could dedicate a whole podcast on training AIs and machine learning and that kind of stuff.
No, but it's more.
I think there is a lot to talk about.
To an on-premises environment, if I can leverage all the resources that are at hyperscale, That makes totally sense, right? I mean, especially if you look at a startup, you don't have a goal to invest into an on-premises environment, nor their primary goal. That doesn't make any sense. They want to solve an issue. And to solve an issue, you need a hyperscale or not. Well, go. Just do it.
Yeah.
I mean...
And by the way, I mean... Yeah, no, I mean, I welcome. I think this is excellent, and I think it's good that it's made available. And it's good that we keep pushing the boundary. I mean, personally, if you say democratizing AI, that's a bit of a stretch. Then again, it's good seeing this.
Well, can I add a small note to because Yitz talked about the whole platform and. What he didn't mention, and I think this is one of the coolest things about this in general, and it doesn't necessarily talk about a technology stack or whatever, is that with the whole partnership that includes multiple hardware vendors as well, we're now talking about GPUs and network cards being able to communicate with each other without specific CPU instructions in the middle. So we have direct PCI communication between two interfaces, where we're talking about smart NICs that have ARM CPUs on the network card that are able to run specific tasks that suddenly now a hypervisor doesn't have to do anymore. So there's so many technology innovations in the technology that come with this, not just this platform, but any platform for that matter. Which are so really, really, really cool about what's happening at this moment. And it,
No, I agree. I mean,
that makes your heart beat faster, Johan. But I think that if you come onto a portal and swipe your freaking credit card, you don't care about all of that, right? It's just a service that you consume. And again, as a technologist, I agree with you, right? I think that technology is evolving, and I think it's a great kind of progress that we're making in terms of getting these services out there in a more effective manner. But in all honesty, if I just consume a service, do I care what kind of hardware Spotify is using to stream their services, or do I care what hardware Netflix has to stream their services? And I guess that's a good segue into our next topic.
Good one.
It's like you actually submitted this topic. Yes. No. Absolutely. I mean,
you made a case.
Johan.
Johan. Sorry.
There you go. It's hard not to laugh making these horrible jokes. Horrible jokes, guys. But yes, Netflix. We all know Netflix. And apparently, this, I guess this surprised me the most reading this article that Case indeed sent in. We all know Netflix as that service provider of movies, series, whatever. This is one of those cloud services where you actually don't care where it's being hosted, how it works. But they are becoming, you know, the world's most prolific producer of visual effects and animated content. And apparently, because they want to attract, well, the world's best artistic talent, I would say, because COVID hit and no one could go into the office, they actually didn't have a solution so that those artists, those creative people, they could not work from home, except when they actually send like one of those big machines with a big GPU and stuff, which makes some people's heart go run faster. They actually built a new solution. So they built a new studio infrastructure, which they created and called Netflix Workstations. And these are remote workstations that allow content creators to get work done wherever they are. Apparently, this is magic to Netflix. I would say every listener and everyone in this show is like, hey, isn't this like VDI? I mean, this is nothing new. It uses a GPU, pretty fancy. But what I found interesting is that they're using NICE DCV, which is a high-performance remote display protocol from Amazon. So I would say this is pretty. And now there are artists working on remote hosted desktops, and it's actually being built by Netflix themselves. Johan, it's 2021. Finally, the year of VDI.
No comment, but yes.
Can you please stand up, Johan, just to see, show off your shirt?
Fuck yeah.
Hey, but
dude, this is always the year of VDI.
Yeah, you're saying this is built on Amazon Web Services, right? I looked into the web page.
No, he didn't say that.
It's not Amazon.
Owned by AWS.
So NICE.
Ah, okay.
NICE. It's a very nice solution. You know, it's a remote.
Very nice.
Very nice. horrible jokes again. No, NICE is one of the remote protocols. We know Teradici, we know PC over IP, we know HDX, RDP. Apache, what's a protocol of Apache? You know
it? Apache Guacamole.
Oh, Guacamole, yeah. So, and NICE is actually pretty good in graphic protocols. So I'm just glad to see that Netflix is pushing the boundaries, right? I mean, they have to support a remote workforce. I think it was last episode that we mentioned about Salesforce killing the end of 9-to-5 workday. It doesn't matter where you work, right? And I think that's excellent. If you are a graphic artist, whether you are in South Africa, if you're in China, Korea, Belgium, wherever, it doesn't matter, does it? And so that's great that we can democratize visual effects.
Dude, and this is
online
just
collaboration for visual designers as well, right? Where they can all work with their own application and see each other changes, etc. Okay, I'm gonna.
This episode,
no, but dude, it's not just Netflix. I'm actually
video marketing.
I didn't mention anything, right?
No. Okay, third time. It's not just Netflix. I'm actually working at a customer or with a customer at this moment who does the exact same. So they had media editors around the Benelux or around the Netherlands, most of them. They shoot, images, media, videos, 4K videos. They need to collaborate on those videos as well. in, let's say, Premiere Pro, one of the tools they use to edit the media. Now that's impossible while working from home. So they are currently migrating all of their editing suites to a new VDI platform. That's of course, you know, built with a shit ton of GPUs, powerful CPUs, and it works really, really, really well. It performs seriously good.
And this ain't easy. I can imagine. I mean, I run a pretty decent MacBook, I would say, and even when I'm editing, if I try to edit 4K videos, that's horrible. So can imagine if you have to do this, you know, collaborating with other people, even when you're sitting like 50 kilometers away from here. I can imagine it's super, super difficult. So this is pushing the boundaries. I mean, we just mentioned democratizing AI, let's say democratizing GPU access. I think this is awesome. But guys, you submitted this topic.
Yeah. So what was the name of the protocol that
Spinnaker used GCP. Again?
Spinnaker.
No, it's Netflix workstations that I use.
It's very nice.
No, but they're making use of Spinnaker.
But that's for automation, right? So So basically, Netflix, they built their own solution, I'd say, in-house. Maybe they use someone else, external knowledge. It's not shared in this article. They build an entire framework so that an artist who comes in is like, hey, I need this. I need this kind of workstation. I need this setup. I need CentOS. I need Windows. I need something else. These amount of processors, memory, GPUs, build it. And that's what Spinnaker used for. And then it used nice TCP for remote access.
So here's the thing that strikes me, right? Because we just mentioned, and Ingmar, you mentioned a couple of them, a whole bunch of open source remoting display protocols. And I was reading the article and I couldn't help myself but thinking, all of this is open source. The whole stack is built out of open source. Is that because of budgetary reasons? Is that a strategic decision? Or didn't the commercial products that are out there that support all of the remote graphics, didn't they supply or couldn't they meet the requirements that a company like Netflix has? Because what we're doing, and you know, that's, I guess when I say we are, it's most of us, it's kind of the key players, right? So it's Microsoft, it's Citrix, it's VMware. There might be a little bit of Nutanix Frame, but that's kind of the landscape that we work in. And I thought it was really interesting to see that Netflix went, well, let's put that aside. Let's look at open source alternatives and build the stacks, that whole stack ourselves. Now, obviously, they have this whole DevOps mentality anyway, because that's how they built their platform. But what drove them towards a stack that is fully open source, while there might be a closed source alternative that is a commercial product? And that's kind of what plays through my mind. And you know, when reading that article, I couldn't wait to ask you the same question. What do you think drove them to a open source stack versus a commercial product in the lines that can do something similar?
Yeah, I think that's a very fair question to ask them. Like why are they in the commodity services? Because I would say all the things that they use here are commoditized services. There were multiple providers that can achieve this, whether it's automation, provisioning, remoting graphics, hypervisors. Everything is commoditized in a way. It's not unique. We all have our differences, but I would say commoditized nonetheless. I don't know. I cannot imagine its cost, right? I mean, you can imagine Netflix has enough revenue to buy whatever they need or to consume whatever cloud service they need. So I would say this is homework for the bigger vendors.
But say, like, isn't this the same with we have seen Google do the same, right? Going with open source, eventually starting up strategic partnerships with bigger vendors just to provide it. Isn't this the same? First, okay.
Google is a cloud provider, right? I'm missing your point.
Google does many of those things. They sold phones. They sold cloud space. They have sold They've sold your soul.
What? Stadia, Google Stadia, right? Their online game.
Yeah.
Platform. I've obviously, tried it. Google have a clue about here, right? Is this all based on? So just shooting the question here, right? Wide in the open. Have any ideas about the? Is this also a approach with Stadia? We're all Googling now, right?
No, I know what Stadia is, but I didn't get the question, I think, right.
But to Kay's question, I think, Michelle Brenner is the one who wrote the article on the Netflix blog site. So we're definitely a guest for one of our podcasts, right, to answer that question that Kay stated.
I love that idea.
Yeah, asking directly is more, it's better than assuming or to try to get in somebody's head and try what they're thinking. So,
it's more fun to start rumors.
Yeah.
Okay.
It definitely is.
Number one, right? So, girl working at Netflix came up with an excellent idea during this pandemic. How can we design person Netflix is still able to contribute to the project? I have a great idea about this platform and went up to his manager and said, "Dear, zero budget, have fun."
Go
but
for it.
And maybe it was just like, hey, you know, everyone is at home. What the fuck? This is going to be a big issue. I have some knowledge on. I already run Spinnaker for whatever in the back end. So why? You know what? I use CentOS. I've seen something about NICE. Let's just use it. And you know what? It works.
Yeah, it was
not everything is a plan. Sometimes, you know, out of accidents, great things happen, as we've seen before.
Gentle nudges.
Getting back to gaming, I know The Legend of Zelda. It was an inside project. It's the biggest thing on Game Boy ever.
There you go. Wait, is it? I thought Mario was.
No. It also was because they didn't want to spend budget on it. So as some like-minded started it, so that's why we got those different characters in The Legend of Zelda on the Game Boy as well as in Mario. And this came out. It's pretty much the best thing ever for Nintendo ever.
See, there you go. I mean, I'm learning so much from you. Zelda and AUC. And by the way, previous topic, I'm trying to make a switching gears. Apparently those visual effects people, they were collaborating. And in another topic, Dropbox, who we all know is a personal cloud storage vendor and is making big steps towards enterprise customers, they are into content collaboration. And actually, they announced to acquire a document sharing platform, DocSend, for $165 million, which is a shitload of money. But then in putting into perspective, we've discussed other acquisitions of, you know, into $20 billion. $165 million. And this comes 2 years after them acquiring HelloSign for $230 million. And honestly, this is paying off pretty well the last months. Everyone is working from home. Everyone is working remote. So, you know, how do you sign those agreements? I saw Box acquiring a Dutch company last month as well. So there's a lot of things going on here. But, you know, Dropbox already had rudimentary file sharing capabilities. This obviously really beefs it up. I've looked into it. You know, it adds powerful engagement analytics. So to me, this is super exciting. That's also because, you know, this is one of those Silicon Valley success stories. And I think it's great that these guys, consumer products, that they are challenging the big leaders in the space, like a Box, like a Microsoft, who are, especially Microsoft, they're commoditizing this space. And yet Dropbox says, I don't care. Maybe I was just a personal, you know, a personal use solution, but I will challenge you. And actually, great segue from the previous topic, one of their premier focus customers of Dropbox is the creative space. So the creators, the artists, that's what Dropbox is doing. Guys, what do you think about them acquiring this? Or even Dropbox as a whole?
From my perspective, Dropbox has always been the one, even in my consultancy role, the one that was seen as shadow IT. And I don't know what way they're going with this, but I think this will always be something they will carry in a enterprise or corporate perspective.
Well, I think you need to differentiate two major things: Dropbox for personal use and the enterprise version of Dropbox. My employer has been using Dropbox for many years as an enterprise solution. And I truly believe that, you know, that's where their value is, right? So file sharing, document sharing. And what they're doing here is adding more functionality into the Dropbox application, if you will, to directly, immediately open up documents, add documents, do more to the documents than you would otherwise use with, you know, you would otherwise use Office 365 or another
still, there is this stigma to add those on documents Dropbox. Instead.
Sorry?
There seriously isn't. No, I won't agree.
You know,
It doesn't really matter.
You need to differentiate between. Well, you need to differentiate between their enterprise solutions and Dropbox for personal use, and the personal use thing. So, you know, being able to easily share documents with your colleagues or with your home situation, whatever, that's completely separated from what's happening here, right?
So Dropbox.
Agree on that, but isn't the mindset of everybody in corporations and enterprises, oh, Dropbox, my data will go somewhere where I don't want it to go?
Only for the short-sighted, honestly. I think Dropbox for consumers, that's mostly being used as an EFSS, right? Enterprise or file sync and share, so to say, right? So the former EFSS market, it's about cloud hosted storage. Hey, I need to store my file somewhere. Yeah, that's the only solution I need. Maybe I need to do some sharing. In the enterprise, it's collaborative. The key difference that they're making in a specific space, and they're doing it in their own way, and I sincerely like it. They got Dropbox Paper. That's co-authoring next level. That is truly collaborating within in their own solution. It's not Office 365. It's not Google G Suite, Google Workspace these days. And with these acquisitions, which they're doing now, is they're making it bigger and bigger and bigger. Now you can add agreements, not just e-signatures or digital signatures. It's agreements in a broader sense. And this DocSend is giving you more insights. And it's not about measuring like, hey, what was the reach? But it is about knowing what's happening, getting insights. And I think insights is the key point here. So I really like what they're doing in like, hey, we're doing our own thing. And I think few months after the pandemic hit, they already said, like, you know what? This got us thinking. This whole pandemic thing got us thinking. We are changing the way we are doing our roadmap. They are rewriting their roadmap, and they are now all into distributed work. And, you know, I think I mentioned it in an earlier call. They also said, like, and we are living this. So we are now not closing down the offices, but they had a fairly expensive lease in San Francisco for their headquarters. They stopped the lease. They are unfortunately letting go 10% of their staff because they were physically associated with that building. But they are like, everything is now distributed. Let's assume the new normal is distributed. And that means you are working somewhere where the other one isn't. So I need a platform. And they want to be a platform. They're bringing in Zoom. They're bringing in Slack. They're bringing in all these various components inside their new Dropbox client. They have Dropbox Spaces. I think you need to look at it because I think it's pretty interesting. Rudimentary task management, it's all basic in a good way, and I would say good enough. So I think this is, they are onto something, and I think it's SMB mid-market, super useful.
But I'm talking to some of the bigger corporations and enterprises in the Netherlands, and I know because I will agree with all of you, but I know they don't see this as a enterprise or corporate graded solution for document sharing.
I agree, but that means that you're disagreeing, right?
Hold on,
let's
guys.
Agree to disagree.
Yeah,
an epiphany. So, Ingmar,
epiphany.
Yeah,
for once.
It's not about signing documents or sharing documents, collaborating on documents. Well, more the legal way of signing documents or contracts, right? So is there today any solution that's leveraging like blockchain technology for?
Yes, but don't ask me the name. I did recently see one of those vendors actually applying a blockchain type of technology, and I think it was around, it is in the realm of digital signatures.
Would make sense, right?
Yeah. I mean, the technology itself of blockchain makes sense. But honestly, I'm drawing a blank here, so I don't know what the name is. But yeah, it's one of those hyped phrases and technologies using blockchain. But I hardly have seen it. And honestly, I don't know if it's adding much value today.
Hey, let's take a step back. If you look at this kind of movement from Dropbox, what do you think happens, or what would be the potential impact to other enterprise file services like Microsoft offers, like Citrix offers? Would there be any impact, do you think? I know, Ingmar, you're well known in this space because you tend to dabble with that kind of vertical. So I'd be very interested in your opinion here.
So if you want my opinion, I mean, obviously I get a market intelligence. So I try to get a perspective on the technology and the use case and the impact it might make on the business. So I do look at their earnings calls, and I would say they try to challenge the bigger movements like Microsoft, like Box. Like I said, they're challenging it. But I would say Box and Microsoft, they're making big waves in the enterprise, small and mid-market. And by the way, small mid-market US size I'm referring here, which is in Europe quite larger. I think they're doing a good job simply because they do it different. They have a different perspective. They do not go with the flow. They let Microsoft and others dictate what important, what they have to go to. As in, this is content collaboration. And actually see content collaboration and content services platforms merge. Content services platforms are the former ECMs, so the on-prem solutions which do document management. And, you see those solutions starting to apply AI. Here it is again. Microsoft had Project Syntex at Ignite last year. Now that's part of SharePoint. It's actually an entitlement for every Office 365 customer. So it uses AI. So you can say if I upload a form, then it will classify
Hold
all
on.
Fields.
Is that an actual reason for to upsell to E3? Or would it be the printer?
It's like printer drivers, because this is for everyone. Project Syntex is actually for everyone. It's a good conversation. So let's make that segue. Maybe it also is the last topic, because we're, well, probably around the hour by now. I think we saw a tweet passing by on like, hey, these are the entitlements, these are the entitlements that you need to start using, I'll just say, universal printer server of Windows.
Holy crap. Dude,
WVD.
What happened? So, seriously, we're going to pay money to use to port an LPT1 port, right? To remote an LPT1 port to a, I don't know.
You just created a monster, Ingmar.
So for you did just unleash the monster, which is called Johan. I think it's good that Microsoft is catching up with WVD, but universal printer service, you need it. I think they're OEMing it, and that's why they need to upsell to E3, E5, or it has a huge COGS, COGS, guys. So it has cost of goods. Johan.
Bad naming.
Bring in the soundboard.
Yeah, here it comes.
There you go. So it apparently brings cost. If you need an E3 and E5, or I don't know, Microsoft needs a reason to upsell to E3, E5. I don't know. Either way, I mean, I'm always fascinated that there are organizations that need to print. Actually, side story. My brother, smaller brother, he's a developer. He builds software.
Your brother print, baby, but.
Oh, no, I don't. I have HP. Huge.
Yeah, I was confused, man. So he, your brother.
He creates software for, I think it's...
And music, GA, right?
Generic, that's why he builds music as well. Hazard, so we call them locally. I don't know what the English word is. But basically, the doctors who's visiting you at home, general practitioner, that these guys print everything. If they go visit a patient, before they go out, they print like a whole stack of papers. Honestly, I was like, dude, it's 2021. And these guys still print. So apparently there is a need for printing, Johan.
Yeah, I always forget my...
Yeah. And all doctors use WFED, apparently. No. Seriously. Why? Well, okay. So the fact that you built a feature, right? That's okay. But why do you actively sell it? It's like, okay, right. We built a car with four wheels.
Wait, what? Four?
You have to no, you're four thinking. Wheels, and now four. We can drive. It's like,
Johan, it's amazing. Like,
okay, right. Okay, so Dr. Ford called. They want their whole story about creating the first car back. Dude, it's not news. It's not news. I'm glad you were able to jump at the last seat in the bandwagon around VDI solutions and being able to print, but it's not news.
Yeah,
I print. Yeah, therefore, I am.
Then again, I mean, it's you know.
Yeah. To print or not to print?
Deep.
That's the question.
I think this is your calling, Mark.
Yeah. I would say that democratizing printing. So, and that's with that. It's time to wrap up this episode of the EUC Digest Throwdown. Thank you all for sticking around. As you've seen, we had fun. We are looking forward to the next episode. If you have a topic you'd like to discuss in the next month, or maybe you want to join as an audience, we figured out we have an option. You can join as an audience. Reach out to us on the social channels. Email us to podcast@eucdigest. Reach out to one of the hosts. And I would say cheers and see you next month at the EUC Digest Throwdown.